It is, what is today's date? Saturday, May 5th. It's 1:10 in the afternoon. Senators, members who are present at this time, Senator Phillips, Davis, and myself, Terrio, and Senator Halford has just joined us. We had noticed four items for today's hearing. I'd like to first take up House Bill 167. Do we have somebody here from Representative Dyson's office? Senator Phillips, are you prepared to speak about Senate Bill, House Bill 167?
Chairman, the only thing that I'm aware of, and I'm no expert on this bill, so I'll qualify that, is that the owners of antique vehicles, which is considered 30 years or older, will get a will pay $30 for their place, a special plate placed on these vehicles. So it'll have, basically, if you have a vehicle that you want to register under this category, it'll say antique car, truck, and then the number, and they'll be charged $30 for that, to have that. Basically, I'd imagine it'll have probably a Model T as a emblem on the vehicle to indicate this. And that is about all I know about the bill. Now, Section 1 I'm not too familiar with. So. Okay.
Is there anybody here from the administration to testify on House Bill 167? Let's just set that aside for a minute. There's somebody from Representative Dyson's office coming. Next, we will go to Senate Bill 55.
Go on here. That's basically what it is.
We do have Commissioner Duncan is here. And Commissioner, I just wanted to touch base with you. Thanks for being patient today regarding some of the information that was brought up in House State Affairs. It's not my intent to move the bill, but I would like to get sort of bring ourselves up to understanding of where we are on the bill. And I have been contacted by some of the pioneers who oppose the bill in its current form but think that there's the possibility of still working things out. I think for myself, when I had asked earlier for an outline of what you thought the regulation package would be and how the whole mechanism would work, it was still fairly sketchy. I don't know if the department had moved on any further along. But I think that might also allay in a number of the fears. Plus, I think it was at the House State Affairs meeting where the contents of this letter to Mr. Leo Kay from Tony Principi was read into the record. And I'm just wondering if you've had a chance to look at it since the time that hearing took place. Perhaps been in touch with the Veterans Administration and can explain some of the terminology in the letter. Because what really jumped out at me when I saw this was that the line that says that the VA State Home Per Diem Grant Program provides federal payments to states for eligible veterans. And I wasn't clear whether that funding flows through the individual veteran or to the state. And then the line where he says, we look forward to working closely with the state to help Alaska meet all federal grant requirements. What are those grant requirements? What strings and hoops would we have to jump through? And the language in here where they talk about possibly either taking over one of the pioneer homes or taking over a wing. Let's see, we may recognize an entire facility or a specific area, such as a wing or floor, within a larger facility. And I think it's this type of uncertainty and maybe using this type of terminology that's causing all of the concern to the pioneers with what exactly this means, where this will take us. So,
go. If I might try to respond to those serious questions, I'll probably miss some, and so perhaps you can remind me, and then also, as we get talking about some of the the benefits, I may ask Mr. Cohen, who's here with me, to help help in that regard. Let me first take the question you brought up about the regulations, the regulation of the veteran's preference. Mr. Chairman, I have copies, if your staff wanted to pass this out to me, I have copies of a letter that I sent to Mr. Bob Huffman, who's chair of the Pioneers of Alaska Legislative Committee, back in March. And attached to that letter is a copy of the letter that I wrote to you as chairman of this committee in February about the regulations. I do realize that the pioneers have had specific concerns about the legislation, and in the meetings I've had with them and with Mr. Huffman as chair of the legislative committee, have tried to address their basic concerns. It's not in the legislation before you now, but in the letter to Mr. Huffman, I recommended that we make at least two amendments, and I today would recommend, as you consider this bill further, you make a third amendment to the legislation to help resolve some of their concerns. One of their overriding concerns was that they did not want the state pioneer home system, the Alaska Pioneer Home System, to fall under federal control and regulations. We agree with that entirely. It was never our intention that that happen. We don't want to be under federal regulations and control, and we want to be sure that's clarified. So in the letter to Mr. Huffman, I recommended that the legislative committees add a clear intent section to the legislation that states clearly it's the intent of the legislature that this remain a state-owned and operated system located within the Department of Administration, and that it's not to fall under federal regulations, rules, requirements, et cetera. The second part of this letter to Mr. Huffman, the second recommendation in this letter to Mr. Huffman is to, in present statute, in present Pioneer Home statute, there is a reference to cooperation with the federal government. That's been in the Pioneer Home statute for almost 25 years. It's not been used. We think it was put there because of the thought that perhaps there would be some Medicaid dollars that could go into the system or whatever, but it's not been used. It's not necessary language. It's just kind of a red flag, and our recommendation is that if you move this bill forward in the future, that you specifically delete that reference to cooperation with the federal government from the Pioneer Home statute. It's not there. So those two amendments, we hope, will address the concern of federal control and regulation and make it clear what the intent is as far as where the ownership and the management of the home should reside. The third recommendation, because they did express concern that the preference by being in regulation might not be, they felt concerned about that they may somehow end up with a de facto veterans home and not a pioneer veterans home mix. The regulation that is in the letter to you, Mr. Chairman, we think is clear. It says that the preference, the 21% preference, will be of the fully funded beds. So if we funded all 600 beds, it'd be 21% of 600. If we have only 500 funded beds, it'd be 21% of 500. So that there would never be a case where you would get more than 21% of the funded beds. Because they had concerns about that, I also would recommend that you consider putting that regulation in statute. That would then resolve the concern that somewhere along the line through a regulation or the regulatory process, the preference would be changed. It would require then statutory action to change it, legislative action. So the three recommendations that we think addresses many of their concerns are contained in the letter that you have on your desk. The intent section, the deletion of any reference to federal control or federal cooperation, and the putting the preference, the veteran's preference, in statute instead of in regulation. And we've asked our drafters to relook at that language. We think that the language that's there that talks about the 21% preference, also talks about the spousal preference, is a language that we would recommend to put into statute. So, Mr. Chairman, that discussion did come up in the House State Affairs Committee. I made the same recommendations there. Of course, they did not move the bill, so that has not yet been incorporated. But I do think that those are changes that could be made to the legislation that would help overcome some of the concerns that the pioneers have. The other concern that they had brought to us was about the name change, and Mr. Chairman, just I want to be sure that we discuss that. We clearly believe it's necessary and important to to change the name of the system to the Pioneer and Veterans Home System, that we need to include in the title veterans in order to fulfill that commitment to the veterans, give them the recognition they mean, and also allow us to continue to work with the VA, the federal VA, to obtain the necessary waivers that we need to get veterans. I think that answers the first series of questions that you had, I hope, or at least it gives you an idea of what our thoughts are as you move forward on the legislation, and I hope would resolve many of the concerns that the pioneers have.
And talking about keeping the federal government at arm's length, do you, it's my understanding when we were setting up the first hearing, we were somewhat discouraged, my staff, I think, perhaps in conversation with yours, with actually having a representative from the VA here. And I don't know if that was because we didn't want to make it seem like they were really stepping in and taking over. But what we're left with is trying to, you know, discern exactly what they mean by sentences on the printed page here. When they talk about meet all federal grant requirements, what would that entail? Do you have any idea?
Mr. Chairman, speaking specifically to the letter to Mr. K from Secretary Principe, and that's the letter you're referring to, and I hadn't yet addressed that. As we read that letter, and as I've discussed it with Mr. Cohn, we believe the letter reflects what is present VA policy. What is present policy as far as the Veterans Administration goes, as far as the requirements that homes have to meet to get recognition so that there can be the flowing of the federal benefits or the VA benefits to the residents of those homes. That letter reflects present policy. Clearly, in the discussion that we had with Mr. Principe when he was in the state in February, I believe it was, when he was in the state with Senator Murkowski and we met with him at the Anchorage Pioneer Home to go through this proposal, we went beyond this discussion, what is currently the VA requirements and regulations and the programs they use in other states, and talked about using a model system, using our Pioneer Home system to expand beyond where they're going. And what we were talking about with Secretary Principe at that point was working with the federal government, working with the VA, to get a waiver to the requirements that are the normal requirements for veterans to receive benefits, but to get a waiver as a demonstration project or as a model program to allow those veterans' benefits to flow to the veterans if they're residents of our combined Pioneer Veterans Home System in the state of Alaska. He clearly expressed, I think, the desire for the Veterans Administration to explore that option, that they really are interested in going away from their traditional methods that they've been using, the standalone veterans' homes, and looking at another model that might be used throughout the country. And we hope that by doing this in Alaska, that would be a model they might follow. So I think the letter clearly reflects present VA policy. We're talking about outside the box. We're talking about a waiver, working with the VA to get a waiver so that we have a different policy that can be used in Alaska by the VA. And as we envision that, there is a daily per diem that the veterans receive if they're in a veterans home, let's say in the state of Washington or the state of Iowa or wherever they are. They receive a daily benefit, veterans benefit. We have 90 veterans in our Pioneer Home System right now. None of them receive veterans benefits despite the fact they're in a facility where they need care. What we are working with the VA to do is to get a waiver so that those VA benefits which they deserve, which are rightfully theirs, can flow to them even though they're not in a traditional standalone veterans home. They're in a new model system that we have here in Alaska. Clearly, and we've had discussions with the Veterans Affairs about that, they were interested, and we hope they still will come to the state in the near future to take a look at our homes to see what is there, how it's operated, what might need to be changed in order to satisfy their needs. But we hope that we can get a waiver where the individual veterans could receive the benefits that veterans elsewhere are receiving. Need to make it clear that this is money that would flow directly to the individual veteran, would not flow to the system itself. The per diem would go to the individual veteran who's a resident of the home. They would then be able to use that money to help pay for the cost of care which if our residents can afford to pay, we ask them to pay. They would use that money to help pay for their full cost of care, but not flow directly to the home.
Okay.
It is possible there would be some capital dollars we could access, but we're not sure about that.
So for the veterans that are currently in the homes, but not receiving those payments, the VA could make that change in their policies so that those individuals could start getting those payments to underwrite the support that they have to come up with as individuals. So that VA decision can go forward, you know, absent this legislation, to help those people currently in the home. Have we gotten any indication that the VA is heading in that direction, actively looking at it, developing something that we could see before we contemplate taking this next step?
Mr. Chairman, I think that'd be a pretty big step for the Veterans Administration, for them to put a waiver in place that would allow those benefits to flow to a resident without us taking some steps to recognize that it is we are recognizing veterans, that we are giving a preference, that there is that commitment to the veterans. I think it's kind of walking down that road hand in hand, that because Mr. Cohn, and he can speak to this in more detail if you'd like, Mr. Cohn has been working with them for several years just to try to get them to help support the medicines for veterans who are in the homes, and we haven't been successful in doing that yet. What we view needs to happen, and what our discussion with Mr. Principi was, if we can show the commitment to the veterans in the state that we think we need to make, rename the system, give the preference, that then lets them take that, which is really a large step for them, lets them take that step of saying, okay, we're willing to, on a demonstration basis, give a waiver, step outside the box of our traditional policy and allow benefits to flow to veterans when they're not in a traditional veterans home. I think lacking either the preference or the name change, it's going to be a very difficult task to get them to take that very bold step on their part.
Okay, but, I mean, with your last statement then, if we did nothing but make the name change, the existing residents then might be able to get those VA funds through?
Mr. Chairman, I cannot give you a good answer on that. I don't know whether the name change alone would be sufficient in the VA's mind or not.
And certainly for some of the seniors, the name change is the most egregious part of this.
Yes, that's correct. For some of them it is.
Senator Phillips.
Jim, I had a constituent meeting here about a month ago, and I guess the question is, why is there resistance from the World War II generation, whether you're a veteran or not, to this thing? I had two individuals that were in their 80s, and I'm almost sure that he served in World War II, and they were also veterans that had our constituent meeting concerned about this. I'm sure you've heard it, so you've probably heard it from a statewide perspective, and I want to hear that too as well, where I'm coming from.
Senator Phillips, that's a good question, and I think it's difficult to give any one specific reason why there is concern. I think there's multiple reasons. One is, the Pioneer Home System has been around since 1913, and there is a long history there, and there's a little bit of ownership been built up by pioneers, and change is difficult. Change is always difficult. So there's that, I think. It's just change is difficult. Also, I think there's been some misunderstanding and misinformation, and we take responsibility maybe for not getting good information out. There's been some folks who believe that this was going to mean that pioneers who'd been on the list for many years were going to be stepped over by veterans and not be able to get into the home, that it wasn't going to fairly treat women pioneers in the state. That it was going to mean that there would be federal control of this system. All of a sudden, we're going to be under federal control and federal regulation. I think all those reasons are reasons why you were hearing concerns expressed, and we've tried to address those, and we think we have addressed those. Pardon? And there are some.
That's what surprised me the most. I'm sitting here, okay.
Yeah, and there are some veterans. Excuse me. I'm sorry, Mr.
He just doesn't want to step up.
Let me say, I agree with you, Senator Phillips. There are some veterans, when we talked to the pioneers, I went to the pioneers in Fairbanks and talked to them, and many of them were also veterans. There were some of those who were expressing concerns and reservations. And they do it again for a variety of reasons, I think. Some of them are concerned about what happens to younger veterans who aren't 65 years of age. A variety of reasons. I guess unless anyone else has a better answer, I can't give you a specific reason. I would say that the veterans organizations, the leadership of the veterans organizations, have expressed support, but some of the individuals are still being hesitant. I apologize for interrupting you.
Well, no, another thing I don't understand, the average age is 85, right, in the Pioneer Home? Give or take a few years? And most of them I served in some shape, way, and form World War II. It's the World War II generation here, and there seems to be a difference of opinion, I guess, among that generation.
I actually think our average age of occupancy is 87.
87, okay.
The waiting list is 83 or something.
Yeah.
But I'm mystified as you are sometimes.
I was surprised when these two individuals, they're 80 and 81, and I know they're World War II veterans that were very concerned about it.
And Senator Phillips, because of the shifting schedule today, some individuals could not stick around to be on teleconference, but we did get some facts testimony today from some individuals, mostly I think identifying themselves as pioneers who are still opposed, still have some major concerns. I think it's a separate packet that we were given. Okay. Well, Senator, Commissioner, I would like to continue to work with your department through the interim. I think Representative Coghill, too, we're both in Fairbanks. Both large military population, large retired military population in both of our districts. And I think we would like to see if there isn't some way of working things out to an acceptable piece of legislation that probably contains many of the things that you now state need to be in the bill. I think the facts that I got from Mr. Huffman, which is dated the 3rd of this month, indicates that he sees good and bad, that things need to be worked out. So I think, on behalf of the seniors that are partners that he represents, there's a willingness to do that. So, but I think what we're going to have to do, though, is bring the VA in a little bit more so that we can talk a little bit more directly, see what they're willing to do, what they can do. And I understand you're saying that, you've been working with them on certain things and you haven't had too much success, but there is a new administration, and I'm not saying good or bad, it's just new people there, and so maybe their willingness to consider things is different. So I think if we could get a lot of things sort of more clarified with the Veterans Administration, it would help with this overall discussion. Senator Davis, did you have a question?
You touched up on one of the things that I was going to mention. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, is that maybe there should be some work done now with the federal VA. You said we have people in the homes that do not get the money. If we would change, that's one of the issues that we worked on. But the people that I've talked to and seen letters that come through my office, the reason that some of the veterans, like World War I, don't want it because they want something dedicated to them alone, not to be a combination of that. So maybe if we could assure them that they're going to be taken care of in an ample way, that maybe they would, that opposition would go away. Because as you say, the organizations are saying that they are for this. But when I saw this letter saying that, they wanted to be a part of, well, the letter pretty much said that they wanted to dedicate some of our homes for the VA. And that's something that would have to be straightened out because that's not where the public want to go at all. They want them to continue to be homes, Pioneer Homes.
Senator Phillips.
Senator Davis' district, but it's mine. The complaints came from the Muldoon or Anchorage side of my district, which is right next door. So obviously there's some concerns here, I think, but I don't know the total picture.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, just in response, we're very anxious and very happy to work with you during the interim on addressing what might be concerns in legislation. And we will continue to work with the VA. There's ongoing discussions with them. General Oates and his staff is also involved, of course, as you know, and carrying forward that discussion. So we'll continue to work with them to see how how we can bring them along and continue to work with you, Mr. Chairman, to see if we can address the concerns over the end. We're very pleased to do that.
Okay.
The other question that I have, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
You said you recommended two amendments on the other side. They have not moved the bill, but did you give those amendments to us?
Yes, they are.
Do I have that here and just didn't see it?
Part of it is a letter, to Bob
and then you
Huffman.
Said,
to Bob Huffman, and then it's got an attached letter to me.
Oh, on the letter part,
it's
yes.
Not formal.
But your third one is not included. Third amendment.
It's the third one. The first two are in the paragraph in the letter to Mr. Huffman. The third one would be to incorporate the regulations that were included in the letter to the chairman, incorporate those into the statute instead of making a regulation.
And then additionally deleting the current statutory language with regard to working with the federal government.
A quick comment, because I know we've got a lot to do here, but if we're going to work this on the interim, there was a letter here from VA about some about 65% paying the funding. If sometime during the interim, if they can flesh that out to not just only us but to the public, I think we get a better understanding. I don't know whether they're committed to it or not, or if the money's there.
I think what they're referring to there is if we were to build a standalone
right.
Provide 65% of the construction cost, the state provides 35%.
Right, but I think that needs to be talked about and fleshed out during the interim.
Let's see. I know we did have some people online that were wanting to testify. I'm not sure if they've all faxed in their testimony. Do we have individuals out on the teleconference network that wish to testify on Senate Bill 55? Okay. Mr. Huffman, are you online in Fairbanks? Or is anyone else still at the LIO in Fairbanks or online at an off-net site? I think many of them probably have left and faxed in testimony. So why don't we go ahead in Anchorage. It is our intent to hold the bill, but if you do want to just make a quick comment since you stuck around to be heard.
Well, this is Ed Barber again. I'm with the Pioneers of Alaska and reside in Anchorage. And it's kind of unfortunate we had, let's see, nine people on very short notice. It appeared at 10 this morning. And they all left. I hung around for a while, and then the gal said that they would give me a call, and they just did call me a little bit ago. So I did hear part of the conversations of the committee. And I would certainly encourage the State Affairs Committee that during the interim that they include all parties, including the veterans, so they can really define what they mean and what they want and what promises or what they can do, because we would really like to know where are the feds and what is it in for? What is in it for them? Where are the dollars? And the other thing is the state VA has several priorities. Number one was evidently the passage of this bill, yet their number five priority was a $200,000 study for a veterans home. Why both? And we just have a whole lot of questions. Why not try a pilot project or demonstration project coordinating with the VA on the existing vets in the home? Prior to trying to, you know, change everything and perhaps really end up with a Donnybrook at the very end. Also, the comments evidently by the federal VA that portions of the homes or all the homes would have to be brought up to their specifications. And we heard among various legislators down there a month ago that $44 million tag would be attached to such an increase in status within the home. And so, I'm sure that Commissioner Duncan and some of the others have heard our concerns previously, and we do have a lot of concerns, especially among some of the older veterans in our organization. So they're very hesitant to becoming involved with the VA on such a situation as espoused by the administration. And we would encourage the committee to make sure that you have a well-advertised place at which people could speak and act, that the actual time would be adhered to. So I had some really concerned women there this morning, and they were really irked with the change, and I realize that you have caucus and that may, you know, that's the way things go, but it would certainly seem to many of those people that there was something sort of underhanded going on. So I think you really need to clear the air and allow everybody to speak and go from there, and especially clarifications of the federal VA's position on such a proposed thing as this bill itself.
Okay.
I'll just quit at that. Thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for sticking with us. We did get a number of fact sheets with testimony, and we do have mailing addresses for those individuals, so my staff will be in contact with them to assure them that their testimony did make it into the packet, and to express our apologies for the disruptive schedule today. Senator Phillips.
Mr. Barber, did you serve in the House in the early 60s?
Well, my father did, but not me.
What's that?
That was my father.
Oh, okay. Okay, okay, my dad knew your dad then.
Okay. Is there anyone else here in Juneau that wishes to testify on Senate Bill 55? Go ahead.
Okay, that was his dad. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee, for hearing my testimony. I am a disabled veteran. I'm a member of the VFW, American Legion, and VF Disabled Veteran.
Could we just get your name for the recorded record, please? Your name?
But don't you have it on a sign-up sheet I signed there? I signed up on a sign-up sheet.
For the recorded record, if you would just say.
Oh. I'm Gene Dow, and I live in Juneau, and I'm speaking for veterans. And I wanted to tell you that when Senator Stevens addressed your joint session of the legislature, I was one of the people that asked him to give this program a plug. And as you know, he did. The first 15 minutes of his speech was dedicated to this bill. And I hoped his speech didn't fall on deaf ears. He said that this would be a win situation for veterans, and it would be a win situation for pioneers. And he thought this was really a step in the right direction. And I met with the senator after he addressed your joint body, and he assured me that we could get the VA funding for this bill. And if he's in favor of the bill and says it's a good bill, and he's the chairman of the Appropriations Committee who handles the money, while he's still in that position, I would have liked to see this bill move sooner, because he's only got two more years in that position. So if we don't move at this session, he'll only have 1 year. And the more time he's got to address the VA, he would have a better chance to work out an agreement with the state and with the VA, so that there wouldn't be any oversight from the federal government. It would be strictly an Alaskan deal. And the veterans would get money and to pay back, to pay to the pioneers. He assured me that, and I've worked with him for over 30 years on different legislation, and he's never led me astray yet. When he comes out and speaks as strongly as he did for this bill, he means what he says. And if he said he can help us get federal aid through the VA, he can do it. That's all I've got to say. Thank you.
Any questions? Seeing none, thank you very much. Okay, we will set Senate Bill 55 aside. We'll be working with the administration through the interim, and I think that is likely to entail, certainly, working just one-on-one between my committee, myself, and the agency, but perhaps some hearings as we approach the session, perhaps down at Anchorage, so that the whatever we come up with that we want to present, that people can have a chance to look at it before the legislative session starts.
Senator Phillips. If we do this, I think probably the best time is September, October. That way everybody's back home after outdoor activities. And then I also would suggest probably the Anchorage Senior Center would be a good place to have the hearing, because everybody congregates there in Anchorage anyway.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, we'll go back now to House Bill 167. Representative Dyson.
Greatest Generation, World War II.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thanks, committee members, for hearing this.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Pretty simple. A bunch of antique car people came to me 3 or 4 years ago and asked me if I would change the law, as it is in several other states, to allow them to, if they can find one, put a year of manufacturer plate on their car. Here's one from 1970. And the department has no problem with it. And it's subject to two things. It has to be legible, the old one they find, and it has to not be a duplicate of an existing one. If so, then they put the little tab up in the corner that we all get and so on, and everybody's happy. Concurrently, while we were working on it, we were asked to make it so that folks that have a National Guard plate, when they cease their National Guard duties, the department doesn't have to go down and chase them out down to pick up the plates. There's probably about 1,500 of them around the state. And no harm is being done. Department's happy with it. It relieves them of the responsibility to chase a few people that have a National Guard plate around. There's no fiscal note, no problems, no opposition.
On the National Guard plate, then, does the person having served in the National Guard have the right then to continue that plate forever, or is it just until the next time it would have come up? Okay. Any questions?
This bill becomes law if I want to buy that 1970 plate.
Thank you.
I have a car for it.
I do not have a prepared CS. Are there any amendments from committee members? Seeing none, as Representative Dyson mentioned, there is the 1-0 fiscal note. What is the pleasure of the committee?
Chairman, I'll move HB 167 out of committee. And what's the next committee or finance?
Okay. Any objections? Seeing none, the bill will move.
Thank you.
Okay, next. I told Senator Lincoln that we get to a brief discussion of her bill. Senate Bill 87. Senator Donnelly, is finance calling you, or well, we should be done here soon, so.
Well, thank you, Mr. President, Senator Lincoln, and I have my aide, Sarah Borrario, who's going to be explaining the bill to you. I'm sorry that we don't have something that we could sell to you or give to you, but I know that you will like this bill and that it will move out of your committees.
You don't come with any VA funds, do you?
This isn't going to cost anything either. So with that, I will turn it over to Sarah.
Chairman Terrio and Senators, for the record, my name is Sarah Borrio, staff to Senator Lincoln. Most of you have probably already had the opportunity to review or read briefly the sponsor statement, so I'll just go over a few points. Essentially, this would extend the 60-day special absentee ballot to voters living in remote areas. Currently, only voters living, working, or traveling outside of the United States are eligible to receive that ballot. This legislation was a result of the Coy family and the Bauer family, whose letters should be in your packet. They contacted our office at the beginning of this session and expressed their concerns, the difficulties they'd faced in the last election. And in fact, the Bauer family, I believe, didn't get to vote. And unfortunately, there are more people that live in Bush, Alaska, who live outside of organized communities, and they don't have any mail service, or it's irregular mail service. and they have a hard time exercising their right to vote due to the limited time frame of the regular absentee ballot. Right now, the regular absentee ballot is 3 weeks before the election. That's when that goes out. And this is not enough time, especially during the winter, and especially, which is when the general election is held, for them to receive them, get to an organized community, receive their ballot, and then get it turned around in time. I know some might ask, why is this important? Why the rush? And as Representative Coghill expressed when he was introduced to HB 109, I believe, he conveyed that, you know, voting is the fundamental method citizens use to participate in our democracy. And like Representative Coghill, we believe that improving the process for even a small number of people is imperative. This is the first hearing this bill has received this session, and I realize next session there might be more time-intensive and high-priority legislation moving through, and we'd like to see this get going so voters are assured in advance of next year's election that the system is in place to improve their opportunity to vote. As the senator mentioned, there's no fiscal impact, and Gail Fanumiai is also here to answer any technical questions. She's with the Division of Elections. And with that,
and Mr. Chairman, I would add that this morning, like the previous bill that was heard, this morning we did have some folks that were online that were going to testify that this bill affected, but unfortunately they were not able to come back this afternoon. Otherwise you would have had heard firsthand experiences.
Question?
I assume, and Gail from Division of Elections is probably going to have an answer for this. You guys have, Gail, you have a definition of remote sites, right?
Yes.
That's the only question I have.
Remote sites are those, according to the, I don't know if there's a specific statute in Title 15.
There's something.
Just where they don't have, where they can't have reasonable access to a polling place. People who live on remote islands that man hatcheries, they don't have daily mail service or, you know.
Okay, so some places in the state statute regulation, there's a definition for it.
Yes.
Okay. But, Gail, I guess one of my concerns is that how many locations do we really have where a person with some planning and some thought can't, through the regular absentee ballot application process, expect to receive a ballot? I mean, we've allowed this for people who are going to be out of the country, and it just, where you're relying on another country's mail system and being able to track the person. And I understand, you know, it's paramount that people be allowed to vote, but there's the people have to take that, take on their own responsibility to make an effort to exercise that duty. And in the department's feeling, do we really have situations where people are precluded?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Terrio. These voters do take the necessary steps to apply for a regular by-mail ballot. It's just that in some of the locations where they live, they may not have mail service. They have to charter planes to get their mail dropped to them. They take the necessary steps to apply for an absentee ballot at the beginning of the year, for all ballots in the year. It's just that later in the year, getting planes in and out of some of these places isn't exactly adequate as far as being able to deliver their by-mail ballot, which is only mailed about 3 weeks before an election. I don't have an actual quantifiable number here for you as to how many people this would affect, but I know we did take some serious, comments from people who were very upset that their ballots didn't get to them in time. They couldn't get their ballots back out of the place where they were, where they reside.
Mm-hmm.
Did that answer your question?
Yeah, I guess. Go ahead.
And in the Shelley Groudon's letter, she's the election supervisor for Region 3. She also notes that there are over 1,000 voters living in remote areas that they're classified as permanent absentee voting areas. And she lists several of the different lakes and areas, and that's only for the interior and Prince William Sound area. That's not the entire state. And while not every single one of those voters necessarily lives in an unorganized community. There are many of those voters who live outside of organized communities and therefore have no mail service. And
but for most of those 1,000 voters, the regular absentee system must work.
Areas that have mail service, if they're in an organized community, the areas she lists are people that she's dealt with in those different rivers and lakes that don't have regular mail service. And so, for example, one of them was icebound and couldn't get to an organized community to get theirs in time. And by the time they got it, it was too late.
And the definition of remote is currently in statute, you said, or elsewhere?
Mr. Chairman, I believe it's in statute, but I don't recall it seeing it in Title 15 particularly. I could look into that for you. This was a definition that was put in there by the drafter, you know, through the Department of Law. And I know that the term reasonable access remote area is used in other locations in statute, but we could look up a definition to see what the exact definition of that is.
Well, I'm just a little bit concerned of wanting to be careful of whatever we put in here, then doesn't make it so. Now, you know, it's almost more your responsibility to make sure that I get a ballot, or you know, that we don't open things up and it becomes a problem now.
Right, Mr. Chairman, I understand your concern. The division would have to figure out a procedure for actually identifying these people, whether or not. There's something that can be noted in their voter registration record that says these people do meet the criteria of living along a river that if it doesn't freeze in the winter, they can't get to the little community on the other side to pick up their mail, those kind of things. That is something that the division would have to take on.
Okay, and what does this special absentee ballot, how does this work right now for somebody that's going to be traveling out of country? When's it available? Who's listed on it? You know.
Add to your question too, and are they afforded a 60-day? And there's a letter here from Ms. Bowers, I guess, saying that there's 60-day overseas ballots. Is that 60 days for overseas? Accurate statement?
It's a 60-day special advance ballot, is what it's called, and it's available for overseas voters and military.
Okay, so she's correct on that.
And what is on that ballot is they get a blank ballot basically with a list of the offices that are up for election in the House district for which they reside, and a list of candidates who have filed for office, for the primary election. And the voter then can either write in the name of a candidate for the primary. They write in the name of the candidate off the list of that. Their ballot comes back in. And they also are sent the official ballot, which is the ballot you would vote at your polling place on election day. As a normal course of business, and they are allowed to vote both ballots and send them back in. If the official ballot is received, count. If it's not, and their special advance ballot is in, we would count that ballot instead. For the general election, they get the same type of ballot, but they have the option of either writing in the name of the candidate or writing in the party of their choice for each office, because they're informed that at the time they are sent this ballot, the election results weren't certified for the primary. Therefore, if they write in the name of a candidate, that person may not have advanced to the general election ballot. And so they're advised that they can also vote by party. That's what the special advance ballot is.
Well, I would, I'd like to know a little bit more about the definition of remote and how it would work. Also, and I'm not saying that this would be available for every location, but you're right, you have somebody out there, a small mom-and-pop mining operation. If they have any kind of telecommunications and operating a business, can they vote by fax, or the fax mechanism that we have, was that only for out of state?
Mr. Chair, the fax voting is available for all voters in the state, out of state.
And I understand there are probably lots of these.
Correct.
That wouldn't be an option. But Senator Lincoln, you've somewhat softened my heart. So we'll get to.
Final blow.
So anyway, we will continue the discussion.
The division really does think it's a good deal and benefit voters in the state, and you know, it there's anything we can do to assist Senator Lincoln, we will definitely.
I want to know how's it going to be defined? How's it going to work? How's it going to be limited? How are you going to control it, basically?
I will get that information. Yes.
Okay.
And Mr. Chairman, you know, we're not going to have huge numbers. I think I can get through to this. We're not going to have huge numbers of people that this would affect. But the idea that, you know, people who so desperately want to vote that perhaps would be denied that access to vote, as, you know, the one couple who paid $532 to go in and vote. So that's, we don't know, you know, other than the two couples that notified us. I guess I'm not so concerned if it's 10, a dozen, or 500, or 1,000, but that if people are denied the access to vote, that if there's a way that we can help them, that's what this bill should be doing.
Thank you. And finally, we will turn to Senate Bill 159. We have Senator Donnelly here. Senator, did finance wrap up upstairs?
Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah, we had it two for the floor out.
Okay. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Senate Bill 159 is a Judiciary Committee bill, and it shortens the terms of office of our current Court of Appeals from 10 to 6 years. And I provided the, from 8 to 6 years.
8 to 4.
8 to 4, yeah. But I would actually suggest a committee substitute that would take it to 6 years pursuant to the research that we've performed since the bill was filed. There's in the members' packets that have this document. I think it's sent around to everybody. There's various systems for selecting judges and retaining judges across the United States. Across the United States, our research shows there are only 8 pure merit states. That's what the Alaska system is called. Of those states, you can take a look at that, and you can see the average length of office for those states and see that the average of the pure merit states is about 7.2 for appellate courts. That's what we're talking about here. And so that Alaska is over the average for the merit states. But the really concerning thing, actually, Mr. Chairman, is that in many other states, even those states that use a mix of the merit system, you find that there are some judges being elected or chosen by other ways, and the amounts are also less. 7 states that use a mixture of systems, including the merit system, and either partisan or nonpartisan elections, the average is 7.7. So once again, higher than Alaska, lower than Alaska. I mean, in fact, the only states where the average is actually higher than Alaska are those states that have legislative confirmation of judicial appointments on the state level. There are 5 states that use the merit system but have the Senate would confirm appointments to their judiciary in their states. And you see that they have a 10-year average there for the courts of appeals. And of those states that actually directly elect their judicial officers in their appeals court, the average number of years is only 6 years. So what this kind of all means to me, Mr. Chairman, is that 8 years, first of all, is above the national average for courts of appeals on almost every level except for those states where they have judicial confirmation of their judicial appointments. And in most other states, they elect the judges directly or through either partisan or nonpartisan ballots is the majority of what states use. And in even those states where the public gets to directly elect the judges, and they're not simply appointed indirectly through this so-called merit system, the average is less than what Alaska has. So that the people in Alaska probably have less judicial oversight, direct oversight, and longer periods of time than all but I think two other states in the union that use the merit system and have the same, that actually use the pure merit system and actually have terms as long as ours. So it looks like Colorado and Utah would be those states. And I think it would be better public policy to have a 6-year period. I know the bill calls for 4 years. The chairman of judiciary wanted the bill introduced as 4 years. I think he's willing to go to 6 years now. Now that we've done this extensive research, I think 6 years would be more appropriate also. So I'd be recommending a committee substitute to just change the 4 to 6. I think that would be much more consistent with the national average, especially considering, well, maybe not consistent, it's hard because there's such a mix, but it would be a fairer system since there's no direct election of judges and there's only the retention election option. So you have less public scrutiny level and less of an opportunity for the public. I think a 6-year would be appropriate, and certainly if you look, it's there's at least 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15 other states have 6 years with increasing variant levels of public scrutiny over. So it certainly wouldn't be a radical concept to go to 6 years. I think it's fairer when you don't have direct elections to have a little bit shorter period of time than we currently have.
Questions? First, Donnelly?
Amendments?
Well, we've got, we've got Chris Christensen from the court system, and then we have one individual on teleconference. So, Chris.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the report. Chris Christensen, I'm the Deputy Administrative Director of the Alaska Court System. As noted, SB 159 reduces the time between retention elections for judges of the Court of Appeals from 8 to 4 years. Senator Donnelly has proposed changing that from 8 to 6 years. We believe this change would have a very negative effect on the criminal justice system in Alaska, and we thus oppose the legislation. Mr. Chairman, unlike many states in the federal government, Alaska has a rigorous merit-based system for the selection of judges. If you read the minutes of the Constitutional Convention, you'll see that the framers spent a great deal of time putting together a system for selecting and retaining judges. They wanted a system that provided for both independence and accountability. They looked at the federal system and saw judges who had almost complete independence, very little accountability, and were essentially political cronies of the president or his supporters. They looked at the systems used in most states, which were elections, and they saw that these judges were totally accountable, but they had little real independence because they ran in contested elections and they knew that their decisions would be reduced to sound bites and subject them to attack ads. Our framers fashioned a brilliant compromise based on the Missouri plan. Judges are selected using a merit-based system. Partisan politics are kept out of the selection and appointment process as much as possible, and judges stand for retention on a regularly scheduled basis. You know, Mr. Chairman, this has actually worked pretty darn well over the years. We have no history of official corruption in our judiciary, unlike many, many states. If you ask someone who's been an attorney in Alaska for many years, they'll tell you that the quality of the bench today is substantially better than it has ever been. We have attracted a lot of smart, hardworking, well-respected attorneys who are committed to what they do. A lot of them took a pay cut to do it. They dispose of about 150,000 cases a year, and in a typical year, there may be only 2 or 3 decisions that I take heat for here in Juneau. Mr. Chairman, if you can think of 15 cases decided during the last 12 months that you don't like, keep in mind that that's 0.01% of our caseload. Speaking about decisions that people don't like, I'm actually a little perplexed to see legislation that affects the Court of Appeals. This is not a court that handles controversial social issues like abortion. It doesn't deal with constitutional amendments or the appropriation power or environmental matters or with public interest litigants. It hears criminal appeals. That's all it does, generally in a very non-controversial manner. We have what is arguably the most protective Bill of Rights in the country. The framers of our Constitution call themselves Republicans. They call themselves Democrats. But the truth is most of them were pretty libertarian in nature. They wanted to keep government in its place. In essence, our Court of Appeals applies the most liberal Bill of Rights in the country to the laws that the legislature passes. And what's the result? A few years ago, I asked a court clerk to look through that year's worth of Court of Appeals decisions and tell me what percentage of the time the court actually overturned a conviction or a sentence. I was told that it was a bit over 10%. That's actually a pretty good rate. That year, almost 80% of the time, the court actually upheld the prosecution completely. The balance of the time, it upheld part of the decision. The public defender has an ugly little joke about the Court of Appeals. I probably shouldn't repeat it in public. They don't call it the Court of Appeals. They call it the Court of Affirmance, because in their mind, that's all it does. It affirms convictions and it affirms sentences. Mr. Chairman, you have to ask, what is judicial independence? It's the ability to judge a case, to interpret and apply the law as free as possible from external influences and pressures. That's what the Court of Appeal does now. SB 159 would have the effect of reducing this ability to judge a case free of external pressure by making judges face the voters at much shorter intervals. Shorter intervals make it more likely that political campaigns will be waged against judges because of single unpopular decisions. Longer intervals give passions time to cool and allow people to take a longer-term perspective on a judge's job performance. If a judge publicly announced that he was going to do a public opinion poll on a case and he was going to base his decision on the results of that public opinion poll, I suspect most people would be outraged. Mr. Chairman, fundamentally, that's the effect of this piece of legislation. Now, it has been stated that the purpose of this legislation is to bring the retention periods for Alaska's judges on the Court of Appeals in line with the retention periods in other states. And Senator Donnelly has distributed a memo which shows this. I would respectfully have to disagree with the memo, however. I would note that the memo, to some extent, mixes apples and oranges. It talks about three levels of court: Superior Court, Court of Appeals, and Supreme Court. Adds up some numbers and draws some generalizations. I actually, since this bill only affects the Court of Appeals, I extracted the numbers for the Court of Appeals. I then went to the National Center of State Courts information and the American Judicature Society information and got the most up-to-date information on what states have Court of Appeals, what their systems are, and how long their retention periods are. And I believe that the staff who prepared this, the memo you have, actually was using so much older data, because there was some information I think that was inadvertently missing, and there was something that changed. The upshot, Mr. Chairman, is that currently there are 39 states that have an intermediate court of appeals. 18 use some variation of the merit selection and retention system for their court of appeals. Of those 18, 10 have terms of 8 or more years. 8 have terms of less than 8 years. So Alaska, at 8 years, is right dead in the middle. Now, there are 21 states that don't have a merit system for their court of appeals. 10 have terms of 8 years or longer. 11 have terms of less than 8 years. So again, we're just right in the middle. Now, you add together these totals for the 39 states, and what you'll see is that 20 have terms of 8 years or longer, 19 have terms of under 8 years. We are dead center in the middle of the pack. Our terms are not long compared to other states. Now, let's forget about numbers of states and let's actually do the averages, as the memo did. This is a little bit trickier because there are, in fact, two states with court of appeals which don't have specific terms. They simply appoint a judge until age 70. That's a hard thing to average in. If you look at our current court of appeals, if we had the age 70 standard as their term of office, one of them would have a term of more than 20 years. Two of them would have terms of more than 25 years. What I've done is lowballed it, and I've assumed that I've called these two age 70 states 15-year terms. That's a reasonable number because, in fact, most of our judges serve 15 years because that's the vesting period for our judicial retirement system. So of the merit selection states, the actual average is just under 8 years. It's 7.9 years. Can't get much closer than that. Of the non-merit states, again, it's just under 8 years. It's 7.8 years. We are right there at the average. It's reasonable to look at this average if you're deciding what the length of terms should be in Alaska. The framers of the Constitution thought it was reasonable. If you go to the minutes of the Constitutional Convention, there was a long debate where they set the retention period of the Supreme Court at 10 years. The testimony was that some members of the Judiciary Committee wanted it to be for life. Some members of it wanted it to be 12 years. They decided to go with 10 because that was the average in the other states. Mr. Chairman, it's also argued that judges in the Court of Appeals have less accountability here than in most other states. While they don't have less accountability than in the four states with Court of Appeals that use appointments without any retention process, I don't believe they have less accountability than in most of the 16 other states that use a merit selection system like ours. I suppose it's true that our judges do have less accountability than they do in the 17 states that conduct elections, contested elections. But you know, Mr. Chairman, that's a good thing. Our framers certainly thought so. When the motion was made to elect judges rather than to use a merit selection system with retention, I believe the vote, it failed on a vote, I think, of 51-2. Keep in mind that many of the framers came from states that had contested judicial elections. They knew firsthand how bad that kind of accountability was. I went to law school in Texas where they have contested judicial elections. 2 years ago, the winner of the open seat on the Texas Supreme Court spent $2 million on his campaign. Approximately half the money came from lawyers who practice in front of the Texas Supreme Court, and the other half came from the insurance industry, which has decided that that's a good way to get tort reform in Texas. Judges who are challenged in retention elections in Alaska do have the ability to raise money and oppose the election. I really don't think we want to create a system where criminal court judges have to raise money to defend themselves from challenges on a regular basis. That's just not good for the system. Mr. Chairman, each litigant should have confidence that his or her case will be heard on the merits and not on the basis of public or political pressure that can be brought to bear in order to convince him to rule in a certain way. The law commands allegiance only because the law commands respect. And it can only command respect if the public believes that their judges are neutral. It would be a great loss to the state if we damage public confidence in the fact that cases are decided neutrally on the merits. We have to remember that ultimately judicial independence is not for the benefit of the judge, it's for the benefit of the public. Mr. Chairman, aside from judicial independence concerns, shortening periods between retention elections would also discourage qualified applicants from seeking judicial positions. Shortened periods between elections would shorten periods of job security. Right now, our judicial salaries are falling pretty dramatically with respect to the judicial salaries in other states. Not taking into account cost of living, most of our judges are in the bottom half or right around the center. Taking into account cost of living, they're now down to the bottom third. Some law clerks, these are people out of law school for 1 year who work for a judge, are leaving the court system with their 1 year of service, and after 1 year of law school going to large law firms outside and actually making more money to start than their superior court judge is making here. An experienced, seasoned private sector attorney may have his income drop one-third to one-half by taking a job as a judge. If you add the increased frequency of retention elections with the increased likelihood that a judge will face an active campaign based on an unpopular decision, you'll be further discouraging the most qualified attorneys from applying. Mr. Chairman, last year there were over 100,000 cases that were within the Court of Appeals appellate jurisdiction. Only a tiny percentage of them were actually appealed, but all of them could have been. Now, a relatively small number were felonies. Most were misdemeanors, violations of municipal ordinances, and infractions. The truth is any one of us could end up in criminal court someday, not because we're bad people, but because we have one brief moment we were careless or had a lapse in judgment. All it takes is a moment's inattention behind the wheel of a car in which someone is hurt. All it takes is misreading a line on a map in order to get a fish and game violation. Criminal convictions have real consequences. They can result in a loss of your reputation, loss of your job, loss of your savings or your house, loss of your relationships, loss of your freedom. The question you have to ask is this: if one day a criminal court judge was making an important decision about your life, what would you want him to base the decision on, his best interpretation of the law, or would you want him to look over his shoulder and sniff the political wind and take into account the personal consequences that might face him if he issues an unpopular decision? Mr. Chairman, I know how I would answer that question. I hope the members of this committee would answer that question the same way. Mr. Chairman, if I could respond briefly to Senator Donnelly's suggestion that that the term here actually be raised from 4 years to 6 years by amendment. I would note that every person currently appointed to the Court of Appeals faces the voters at the first general election 3 years after appointment. The 8-year retention terms only kicks in after they face the voters that one time. That gives the voters a chance to look at a judge right away and see what kind of a job he's been doing, if he's been lazy, if he's up to the task. There already is a short period in the law for that first time around. The effect of this bill would be to reduce the independence of our Court of Appeals judges. And please make no mistake, if you reduce the terms from the current level, you're really buying into this goal. It may not be as bad, 6 years may not be as bad as 4 years, but you are, in essence, making the statement that it's not a bad thing if criminal court judges consider public opinion when they issue their decisions. As noted, our retention terms are dead center. 6 years would put us substantially below what is now the average for courts of appeals, both in merit selection states and non-merit selection states. I would also note that the Supreme Court currently has a 10-year retention term, the Superior Court 6 years, and the District Court 4 years. 8 years for the Court of Appeals fits right into that structure. That's why the legislature chose 8 years in 1980 when it created the Court of Appeals. 6 years would give it a term equal to the term of the Superior Court. That's a court with less responsibility, a court that has to make fewer controversial decisions, a court where the buck doesn't stop because the decisions can be appealed up, and essentially a court that doesn't have as much need as a higher level court for judicial independence. Mr. Chairman, I know there's a natural tendency of the legislature to compromise, to try to make everybody somewhat happy. Sometimes compromise is not a good thing, and I do believe that even 6 years would affect the Court of Appeals and the system very negatively.
Are there questions for Chris? And I understand it's your birthday. Happy birthday. Senator Phillips.
Chris, when was the Court of Appeals established? 84, 86?
Mr. Chairman, I believe it was 1980.
80.
There was a proposal at that time to increase the size of the Supreme Court,
right,
to 7 justices.
I voted against this, by the way.
The legislature chose this method instead.
I think the fiscal note was like $1.5 million or 2.5, something like that. Remember the fiscal note on that?
Mr. Chairman, if we were to create, we have just run these numbers up in Senate Finance, and if we were to create a new Court of Appeals right now, identical in size to the one we have, I think it would be about $1.4 million.
Right, okay, I remember the fiscal note. Well, I voted against it, so whether you did or not, Rick.
Here, the Senate bill is chiming, and we do have Bill Cotton online. Mr. Cotton, are you online right now?
Yes, I am, Mr. Chairman.
If you would go ahead with your comments, please. And we do have a 2-3-page sheet from the Alaska Judicial Council. If you were going to make reference to that, that is in the packet.
Thank you very much. For the record, my name is Bill Cotton. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Judicial Council. The Council is a small agency in the judicial branch of government, separate from the court system. We are charged primarily with investigating and screening judicial applicants and with evaluating the performance of judges and making available to the public evaluation information and retention recommendations. There's a number of reasons why the Council opposes SB 159. First, I need to address the assertion that we have less oversight and less public scrutiny of judges in Alaska. That's simply not the case, and it's not the case even in those states that have shorter terms. In fact, there's not another state that surveys every attorney in the state, mails a summary of the survey to every voter, and puts the detail of the survey on the Internet. Not another state that does the same thing with peace and probation officers as we do. Not another state that does the same thing with jurors, court employees, social workers, guardian ad litem that we do. We're the only state that checks appellate record, peremptory challenges, recusal, salary warrants that are withheld, and puts all that information on the Internet for voters to take a look at. Statewide public hearings, evaluations by the Independent Court Watch organization. There's a long list of things that I won't go through. The fact is that we surveyed about 10,000 Alaskans last year on the performance of judges, and that information is all available. There's more oversight in Alaska than anywhere else in the country or in the world. second, the implication that Alaska, the Alaska Court of Appeals terms are generally less than other states. Again, as Mr. Christensen said, that is simply not the case. We are right in line. In fact, the majority of states that have intermediate appellate courts have terms of either 8 years or longer. And Senator Donnelly's figures don't substantially disagree with
the
that.
The last numbers they brought us were bogus.
Third, and I will try to move on as quickly as possible, the council does believe that this would at least have a marginal discourage effect on qualified applicants, especially those who have stable practices in the private sector, who are representing private citizens. We had difficulty, in fact, we failed to fill two district court positions just in the last year, one in Anchorage and one in Bethel. We redid the Anchorage vacancy and were able to get two qualified applicants. We haven't been able to do that with Bethel yet. This is a real concern. Next, by increasing the number of judges under review and on the ballot, we really take the focus off the individual judges and put it on a larger group. One of our problems the last year is we had 30 judges up for review. That makes it very difficult to do a thorough evaluation on each one. It makes it harder to focus on each one and harder for the voters to get a clear understanding of each one of those judges' records. The intent here is to increase review. The effect may be the opposite. Fifth, this will marginally increase cost. The Judicial Council did file a very, very small fiscal note. Presumably, there would also be relatively small cost from the Division of Elections. Next, and what Mr. Christensen mentioned, probably the most important reason the Council objects to this proposal is that it does upset the balance that our constitutional framers set between judicial accountability and judicial independence. I've emphasized judicial accountability. That is a critical element of the council's job, but judicial independence is critical also. It's one of the basic principles that our country was founded on, having judges who could protect the rights of citizens, even if it didn't please the king. We want judges who are fair, fast, polite, smart, but we also want judges and need judges who decide cases based on the law, not who the parties are, not who is going to make campaign contributions, and not what is temporarily popular. The branches of government in our system have different purposes. We elect a governor and a legislature to carry out a political agenda. On the other hand, we select judges to decide cases based on the law and constitution, not an agenda. Our delegates discussed the issue of selecting judges, of evaluating the performance and retaining judges at length, and I won't go through the quote that I had prepared for you given the time constraints, but they did specifically vote by an overwhelming majority not to reduce the term of the only appellate court discussed there, the Supreme Court, from 10 to 6 years. Our system certainly is not perfect. Nothing involving people ever is. But like the delegates to our constitutional convention, the council strongly believes that our system, on the whole, is truly excellent, and it's one that's respected across the country and across the world. The council urges you not to upset the balance with this proposal. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Senator Davis, did you have any questions for Mr. Cotton?
No, I didn't.
Senator Donnelly, did you have a question about one of his statistics?
Yes, I do. I had several. I'd just like to generally respond. I look forward to copies of Mr. Christensen's research, and so I can compare any conflicts with our research, because the last research we got from the Judicial Council was quite faulty, Mr. Chairman. They alleged pure merit states. They said gave a list of merit states where, in fact, in many of those states, many of the judges are elected, and they are not simply merit states. So I'd like to see if they're using that same data or if they've got some updated data that's more accurate. You know, both Mr. Christensen and Mr. Cotton are lawyers, and when you're a lawyer, you know, and you've been in debate class, you know, you use the sometimes use the scattergun effect. You name so many different little arguments that, you know, it's hard to go back and adjust the merits of each one. But I think there's a lot of faulty logic in a lot of these little arguments that have been raised. And if you go through and look at them individually, they're not going to be so convincing. First of all, this argument of merit states. First of all, most of these states, there's very few pure merit states like Alaska. Our research is that there is only seven that didn't have either legislative confirmation or some other lower level of judges being elected. And when the public has the opportunity to elect the lower level judges, they're more accountable. It should certainly have an impact on the upper levels of the judicial management also, or the judicial process. So from a political science point of view, it's very important that there be greater accountability for those lower judges, because that's going to have a big impact on what the upper judges are going to see. So to ignore the fact that you're electing the lower judges when you talk about the accountability of the upper judges, I think, is not logical and not fair. Additionally, the argument was made that somehow this is going to gum up the election process because people wouldn't have time to look at all the judges. Well, my goodness sake, what a feeble argument that is. We only got three judges on the Court of Appeals, and so you reduce them by 2 years, there's going to be several years involved there where you're not even going to see a judge. It might be one more judge on the ballot. At the most, you'd have three on the ballot. That's certainly not going to be any major effect on the ability of the citizens to analyze those judges. That's just another one of the shotgun debate techniques that was used here today. And upsetting the careful balance of the Constitution? Well, Mr. Chairman, the Court of Appeals didn't exist at the time the Constitution of Alaska was written. So it has nothing to do with the careful balance of the Constitution. In fact, it was created by the legislature many, many later years. So to argue that somehow this was anticipated, this Court of Appeals, in this particular time frame was contemplated by the framers of our Constitution is strictly erroneous. So I guess there's a lot of good things the Judicial Council does, and that's good. But 8 years is simply too long between these elections for these type of officials. I believe that a vast majority of Alaskans would agree with me, and the polling numbers that we actually did, by the legislative majorities did, which are public information and were provided to the public, show the public agrees that the judicial terms in Alaska are too long, and the vast majority of Alaskans would support lowering these terms so that they have more accountability and the opportunity to vote on them occasionally more often. So, and this bill does not abandon the merit system. We've talked a lot about the merit system, how good it is. That's fine. But that's not what's before this committee today. What's before this committee is going from 8 to 4 or 8 to 6 or whatever option there is. And I'm suggesting from 8 to 4. I'm not suggesting, or 8 to 6. I'm not suggesting the abandoning of the merit system here. But I do suggest that we are in extraordinarily generous and long terms of office compared to the lack, through the pure merit system states that are out there, and not considering that all these, the vast majority of states have some degree of elected judicial officials in the process. And I do disagree with Mr. Christensen's suggestion that the Court of Appeals has been uncontroversial. All you have to do is look at the efforts of this legislature with regards to evidence rule 404B to see that this Court of Appeals has been willing to frequently ignore the intent of the legislature and impose their own political point of view upon the evidence rules. And I say that because for many years as Judiciary Chair, we attempted to simply bring Alaska into conformance with the meaning of evidence rule 404B. The Court of Appeals refused to do that. I think we made two or three attempts, and all we wanted was for that exact same language in Alaska to be considered the same as what the federal courts interpreted that language to be. The Court of Appeals stood in the way and has blocked that for many years. So to say they're uncontroversial, I do not think is accurate. Maybe that's just an exception to the rule, but I think it was a very important exception and indicates a propensity by the Court of Appeals to not want to be willing to even follow the national standard as far as evidence rules in the criminal justice system, or let alone the express intent of the legislature. And I was particularly distressed when they manipulated the decisions to somehow say we didn't mean what we meant. It was quite phenomenal, the lengths the courts would go through to try to argue that we didn't really intend to do what we clearly intended to do, when it wasn't what they wanted to do. So I would suggest they have been controversial in some extent. So that's my brief effort to try to address the shotgun technique of debate here.
Senator Connolly, I agree with your assessment, and I can go through those arguments, and one of them is like, that one doesn't carry any sway with me, and some of the ones that you question. I would likewise move them aside as not being particularly useful for me in making my decision. I would like, when I told Chris that we were going to schedule this for a hearing, he said that, and you had provided a memo, and he said, well, we have a differing opinion, but I did not get his numbers until today. I'd like to know, you know, have you take a look through them and respond to them and point out any flaws. But philosophically, for me, I guess the fact I personally haven't felt as much criticism of the Court of Appeals, but you bring up something that I think I'm just largely unaware of, a particular problem. And maybe I am aware of things the legislature's been trying to do and not necessarily fully understanding where the problem actually lay.
I'll give you another example, Mr. Chairman. There is an interpretation of the statute that requires a mandatory 99-year sentence for people who commit multiple murders, torture murders, or murders of a police officer or fireman in the line of duty. The court produced a very bizarre opinion, in my opinion, saying that the person had to be notified at the time of sentencing that they might possibly be subject to that sentence. Now, that is very unusual in American jurisprudence. Usually the sentencing issues are totally separate than what the charging issues are, and that was completely disagreed with by the Department of Law. I think it's very unusual in American jurisprudence, and it's another example that I think where they've been highly controversial.
And one of the things that weighs on me personally is the trying to get good private sector attorneys interested in the judiciary. And I think we've had a problem with that. And part of it might just be maybe that we've just had Democratic governors, and they appoint from the end of the spectrum, that perhaps I would gravitate to the other end.
Or Republican governors.
But we're going to be, I mean, Tony Knowles is termed out here. So we might have a bite at the apple here. And but that one in particular weighs heavy on me. And with the 3-year and then 8-year, I mean, these people aren't, they're being elected, they're coming up for election twice within an 11-year period of time, at three years and then eight years. So, and I think when we talked about other legislation, you said, well, 3 years is probably too short for people to really see what this judge is all about. But the original bill, although you're now wanting to amend it to 6, was just 4 years. So,
Mr. Chairman, could I understand you don't intend to move this legislation today. Could we at least adopt a CS version that was at least to 6 years so that the debate over the increment could be about 6 years rather than 4 years?
I agree with that. I will move an amendment to the Senate bill that we have a draft drawn up that will say 6 years. And that will be the document that we have in the committee for discussion purposes. Is there any objection to that?
No.
Okay. Seeing none,
I'll move it for you since you're the chair.
Thank you. I would like to have you review Chris's information and let me know what flaws you see in that. Okay. With that, we are adjourned for the day.
Thank you very much.
Most likely for the session.
We didn't have a session. We could just have this long, long debate between the two.